In this lecture 9, we're going to look at biological targeting and the potential of combining biological targeting with radiation therapy. The rationale here is that, as we've already said in earlier lectures, there are aspects of cancer biology which are unique. For example, tumor oncogenes, tumor suppressor genes, tumor microenvironment, and these allow biological targeting to take place. At the same time, many of these affect the radiation response, and therefore, by targeting the cancer-specific effects, one can also target the radiation responsiveness. So, really, it's this link between cancer biology and radiobiology which is at the heart of biological targeting. As we've already said, the gain of function mutations resulting from oncogenic mutations really conspire with loss of function mutations in tumor suppressor genes to affect molecular signaling pathways. And it's these that are basically the hallmarks of cancer. We know that cells differ dramatically in terms of the response to radiation, even in terms of the surviving fraction for 2-gray in vitro. And this is a clear indication that although the amount of energy which is deposited within a cell and the number of ionization events per cell are the same, the actual response in terms of cell survival can be markedly different. We know that oncogenes can affect radiation resistance, and this is nothing to do with transformation per se or the fact that one has a cancer. It's to do with the fact that these pathways are being activated. And it's activation of the signal transduction pathways that alter the intrinsic radiation sensitivity. And we've already said that there are kind of general guidelines coming out in terms of how this mechanism operates, so that activation of cell cycle progression and survival generally increases radiation resistance. Activation of pro-apoptotic or cell cycle arrest pathways generally radiosensitize. So, all of this really is based upon the fact that there are a large number of biological targeting agents which have been developed. There are small molecule kinase inhibitors. Here's a list of some which have been FDA approved for a variety of indications. Most of these target kinases directly, however, some are also the indirect in their action, for example, bortezomib or Velcade-X by inhibiting proteasome function. At the same time, there are also a large number of FDA-approved monoclonal antibodies available. Most of these are against molecules on the cell surface, either receptors or other molecules. Although some of them, such as Avastin, are actually directed against ligands. As can be seen for the preliminary data which have been presented for these and which led to them being FDA approved, some of them are not particularly striking in the terms of efficacy. One has to remember that many of these are also extremely expensive. The cost of treating patients tends to be in the order of about $100,000 per patient year. So one of the big questions is, where is molecular targeting going, given the fact that many of these agents are not outstandingly effective? They certainly can be quite specific for cancer, but on their own, they tend to be at best cytostatic rather than cytotoxic. And in order to cure cancer, you need to kill all cancer cells. So it makes sense to actually use molecular targeted therapy in combination with cytotoxic agents like radiation. after a great deal of discussion. In fact, there was a trial which was performed, which is the first to show efficacy with one of these agents in combination with radiation, and this is the trial with cetuximab. Essentially, it was based upon a small trial where it shows 13 complete responses and 2 partial responses in 15 evaluable advanced head and neck squamous cell cancer cases who received cetuximab with radiation therapy. It's clear from this phase 3 trial that the median duration of a local regional control was increased from 14.9 months to 24.4 months. And this translated into an increase in survival from 29.3 months to 49 months. So there is clear evidence, therefore, from this trial that radiation therapy works with cetuximab to significantly prolong progression-free survival. The toxicity was largely related to the ichneumon rash and the infusion reactions that developed in a number of patients. The incidence of grade 3 or greater toxic side effects didn't really differ, however, significantly between the two groups. It should be remembered that this trial was actually done in the era just before chemoradiation therapy became the standard, and so these patients did not get any chemotherapy. The rationale for cetuximab use is, of course, the idea that EGF receptor expression is often increased in many different types of cancers, as we said in an earlier lecture. And there are many mechanisms whereby this can occur. We also know that EGFR activation causes radiation resistancy, and that blocking EGFR activation radiosensitizes tumor cells. It's also important to realize that radiation actually induces EGFR phosphorylation more or less directly, and this is a very rapid effect of radiation exposure. And this can, in itself, lead to tumor cell proliferation. So targeting EGFR makes a lot of sense in combination with a radiation therapy protocol. Interestingly enough, although there's an inverse relationship between EGFR expression and overall treatment outcome, and EGFR is a strong independent prognostic determinant for overall and ZSV survival. There is actually a little correlation, if any, between EGFR expression and the response to EGFR inhibitors. Furthermore, there's no good in vitro models for looking at EGFR blockade. In spite of this, there has been a very large amount of effort and money put into development of EGFR targeting agents, both monoclonal antibodies and small molecule inhibitors. And the preclinical data that have been developed support the idea that this is a rational and useful kind of approach. So this is work from Luca Milas's group, showing that a single injection of C225 or cetuximab potentially potentiates the effects of radiation. However, giving 3 injections of cetuximab along with radiation therapy results in a very good response against the A431 head and neck squamous cell tumor in mice. It's also true that if you look at the tumor control probability curves, these can be seen to shift to a lower dose to achieve TCD50 data. It's also been looked at in combination with fractionated radiation therapy. This is some data from Huang and Harari, showing 2 different tumor models, the combination of C225 again with multiple doses given along with radiation therapy have a positive advantage. In spite of this positive data, there is some data which suggests EGFR inhibition doesn't always change tumor control following radiation therapy. This is some data from Michael Baumann showing that the TCD50 didn't significantly change, for example, with the FADU tumor given 30 fractions over a 6-week period. This was done with a small molecule inhibitor. Whenever a monoclonal antibody was used, using a single dose system, that there was really very little difference if the monoclonal was continued after radiation or whether it was given before radiation. This, however, was not the case for A431, showing that there are differences between tumors in terms of the response to EGFR inhibition. The mechanisms of action of EGFR inhibition with radiation therapy are still a little bit obscure. Certainly, one thinks that one might be blocking ligand binding using, for example, the monoclonal antibody, by decreasing the phosphorylation status of the EGFR, then one should be preventing many of the downstream effects which are consistent with the idea that this is a real mechanism of blocking of a signal transduction pathway. However, other mechanisms have been proposed. For example, the fact that EGFR nuclear translocation seems to occur, in particular after radiation. This might lead to binding and blocking of DNA repair enzymes. There have been suggestions that blockade increases radiation-induced apoptosis. It has effects on the cell cycle. It decreases tumor cell proliferation, and perhaps this will affect accelerated repopulation during radiation therapy. It has been thought to improve reoxygenation, to block angiogenesis, and to inhibit tumor cell invasion and metastasis. And finally, just the fact that one has a monoclonal antibody binding to tumor cells suggests that this might be recognized by the immune system, and there might be immune involvement in terms of tumor cell regression. In spite of the uncertainty as to the exact mechanism, there are lots of clinical trials which are ongoing or planned. And not all of these have actually been successful. There are a couple of trials which have been studied, which have combined cetuximab, for example, with capecitabine and radiation therapy with rectal cancer, with only a 5% pathological complete response rate. And the same is true for a study with oxyplatin with in rectal cancer, with a 9% pathological response rate. So it's not terribly clear at this point in time whether this is something which is an issue with rectal cancer or whether it's the design of the trial. It's certainly important to realize that one needs biomarkers to identify patients who are going to respond. Unfortunately, EGFR positivity per se is not a good marker for response. And in fact, the acneiform rash that develops following administration of the monoclonal antibodies tends to predict better than most other markers that have been looked at exactly what patients are going to respond. I think there are lessons to be learnt as we move forward with biological targeting in combination with radiation and just biological targeting in general. One of these lessons comes from the Eressa story, or Gefinitiv story, where it was given to a large number of patients with lung cancer. In fact, there was found to be no survival benefit from taking Eressa in these patients. And the FDA decided that this was a poor situation to get into, and there were other drugs which were likely to be much more effective. In fact, the FDA approval for Eressa was based on data from clinical trials showing a shrinkage of tumours in about 10% of patients only. It costs AstraZeneca a very large amount of money to perform this essentially negative trial. Interestingly, a few years later, or even less than a few years later, there came some interesting studies showing that, in fact, if one sequenced the receptor tyrosine kinase genes in non-small cell lung cancer, the patients who responded to Eressa were actually shown to have mutated EGFR. And these mutations were also found in US patients. They were initially found in Japan, but they were also found in samples from US patients. So the results suggest the EGFR mutations actually may predict sensitivity to Eressa. And the concept here is that the drug binds better to molecules that are mutated. So again, one needs to think again of why some of these strategies are failing. And one of the most important aspects of this is the need to define the critical and vertical and horizontal pathways that might intersect to bypass efficacy. You know, we've already talked about the EGFR pathway and how there are many molecules downstream of EGFR which are important in cancer. In molecules like RAS, SRC, PI3 kinase, P10 and ACT. And this slide I've shown already once before to show that many of these downstream molecules can be mutated. Both RAS, SRC, P10, PI3 kinase and ACT, all of them are often mutated in different types of cancers. And one of the most common mutations in cancers is, of course, RAS. And the data suggests very clearly that in at least some clinical trials, KRAS mutations can affect the response to EGFR targeting. So in fact, in response to panitumumab in metastatic colorectal cancer, the patients who responded all had wild-type RAS. And so one is left with the conclusion that, in fact, because RAS is downstream of EGFR, if this is mutated, it's always on, and it makes no sense to target molecules which are upstream of this molecule. So in order to do these kind of trials properly and effectively, it's necessary really to get involved in a treatment decision validation kind of process where the tumor is diagnosed, it's molecularly profiled. Based upon that molecular profile, there should be a prognosis which is delivered. Based upon pathway usage, a critical target would be identified. There would be monitoring throughout the trial to validate the reliability of the biomarker which has been chosen. There would be phosphoprofiling or other studies undertaken in order to make sure that that target that has been chosen is in fact being knocked out. And all of this should be taking place before there is a clinical response assessment. Molecular imaging, of course, will play a big role in some of these studies as well. To move on to another target that is becoming more and more popular, NF-kappa-B is a transcription factor that plays a major role in inflammation and immunity. And the importance of inflammation and immunity in cancer should not be underestimated. Certainly, inflammatory cytokines are thought to play a role in the etiology of many types of cancer, particular with respect to ROS production. NF-kappa-B is a survival factor for many cell types. The reason why it's a survival factor, it seems largely because it transcribes anti-apoptotic factors, the so-called inhibitors of apoptosis. NF-kappa-B is induced by radiation, particularly in the higher dose range, and this could result in increased survival of cells following radiation exposure. One of the molecules that are linked to NF-kappa-B is cyclooxygenase 2. This is responsible for the conversion of arachidonic acid to prostaglandins and other eicosanoids. And this plays a major role again in inflammation. And COX-2 also is overexpressed in many cancers. And epidemiological data is available suggesting that blocking COX-2 with selective COX-2 inhibitors, and certainly with NSAIDs, might prevent the development of cancer. So the question has arisen whether selective COX-2 inhibitors would actually enhance the tumor response to radiation and chemotherapeutic agents by blocking the production of prostaglandins and or NF-kappa-B. Certainly in prostate cancer, it appears that COX-2 is an independent predictor of distant metastasis and treatment failure. The situation is less clear in other cancers, but certainly there are high levels after preoperative radiation therapy have been found and associated with distant metastasis and poor prognosis. So one can see that elements like COX-2 play a major role in the pathway, which leads to a large number of features of cancer which are known to be associated with a poor prognosis. Here in Taiwan, Chen et al. Have shown a poor survival of patients who have high levels of COX-2 with T4 nasopharyngeal cancer treated with radiation therapy. And there are a large number of both non-selective and selective COX-2 inhibitors have become available in recent years. And many of these have been looked at in preclinical models for efficacy. Again, in preclinical models, there are some suggestions that perhaps any activity which is found is not necessarily due directly to inhibition of COX-2, but it's certainly true that many of these agents are able to work with radiation to cause radiosensitization. This approach has been somewhat put on the back burner as a result of the problems with selective COX-2 inhibitors in terms of giving vascular damage. However, it probably is true that there is a very large reservoir of approaches here which can be exploited in the future. A more obvious approach from a radiation therapy point of view is to exploit low tumor oxygenation using hypoxic cytotoxins. We know that hypoxia causes resistance to radiation and anti-cancer drugs. Terrapezamine for many years has been the main lead compound in this effect. The mechanism appears to be the production of radicals as a result of reductase conversion. Oxygen appears to drive this process back towards the original molecule. However, on the hypoxic conditions, these radicals are then free to bind to DNA and cause damage. The original demonstrations by Martin Brown that terrapezamine is toxic for hypoxic cells in vitro led to multiple clinical trials of this agent, and these were to a certain extent encouraging. However, in recent years, terrapezamine has been taken off the market, largely because of some of the side effects which have been associated with it. We have already discussed the tumor vasculature as a therapeutic target and how this can be performed using vascular targeting or anti-angiogenesis approaches. The advantages of vascular targeting are that many thousands of tumor cells depend upon each blood vessel, and so theoretically, just causing damage to one endothelial cell can result in a considerable amount of tumor cell death. Delivery of agents by the bloodstream, of course, is not a problem, and endothelial cells, being genetically stable and non-transform, are less likely to develop treatment resistance. One of the major angiogenic factors is VEGF, and there is a large amount of information available upon VEGF and it's in cancer. For example, the VEGF level of expression has been associated with microvessel counts within tumors and also with poor survival in a number of different tumor sites. Targeting VEGF with Avastin has entered the clinic. It's the first-line treatment for patients with metastatic colonic cancer. In combination with 5-FU-based chemotherapy. Patients receiving Avastin along with 5-FU, either as a bolus or with 5-FU leucovorin, show an increased overall survival and progression-free survival. There are a number of ongoing trials of Avastin in combination with radiation therapy in particular, for example in glioblastoma. Targeting oncogene expression using monoclonal antibodies or small molecule inhibitors has obviously taken precedence over targeting tumor suppressor genes which are lost in cancer. The reason for this is obvious, that basically replacing loss of function is a lot harder from a therapeutic perspective. The major approach here is to use gene therapy. The disadvantage of gene therapy is that from a regulatory point of view it's much harder to do. It requires that all tumor cells really should be targeted. And no vector currently available has 100% efficiency of gene transfer in vivo. And most of these vectors, of course, also have associated toxicity that limits the dose that can be used. It is, however, possible to use, for example, adenoviral vectors to get a reasonable amount of gene expression into tumors. And it's certainly possible to do this for example, to introduce P53 into tumors, in this case into the SCOV3 ovarian carcinoma line in vitro and in vivo, meant to show that replacement of P53 will result in radio sensitization, as one might expect. Lack of good vectors dictates that amplification mechanisms need to be exploited. This makes the approach less than ideal. Current approaches to overcoming vector limitations really are based upon replicating adenoviruses or using tissue-specific or hypoxia-specific or radiation-specific promoters. None of these really have been particularly effective, although this may be in large part due to the difficulties of putting this approach into clinical practice. Certainly it's worth thinking of the future of radiation therapy in this post-genomic era. It's important for radiation oncologists to realize that the pathways that are responsible for cancer are also often the pathways responsible for resistance to treatment, and that molecular targeting on its own, while being intellectually satisfying, is unlikely to have a major influence upon outcome. The reason for this is that most of these approaches are largely cytostatic rather than cytotoxic, so it makes sense to combine them with conventional treatments, and radiation therapy is certainly an approach which is of considerable value.